אם אשכחך ירושלים, אם אשכח ימיני, אם אשכח
וידבר משה אל ראשי המטוס לפני ישראל לאמור, זה הדבר אשר ציווה אדוני, איש כי ידור נדר לאדוני. O hishava shivua lesor isor al nafsho lo yachel divaro kechol hayotzei mipiv ya'aseh. Moshe spoke to the heads of the tribes of the children of Israel, saying, "This is the thing that Hashem has commanded. If a man takes a vow to Hashem, or swears an oath to establish a prohibition upon himself, he shall not desecrate his word. According to whatever comes from his mouth shall he do."
Thank you. Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Come right over. Chair by the window. Comfortable?
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Matot. Recording and first availability. Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 22nd day of Tammuz, 5776, corresponding to July 28th. I said the parsha is Matot. That is correct for Israel, as I've repeated several times, and will stop repeating when we no longer need to. We in Israel and the rest of the Jewish world are out of sync as far as Torah reading is concerned. It happened this year because of the eighth day of Pesach, which was a Shabbat, which in Israel doesn't exist. The day following our seventh day and the end of Pesach was a regular Parshat HaShavua. Outside of Israel, special Torah reading for the eighth day. Therefore, we jumped ahead one sedra, and therefore we're up to Matot this week, and in Chutz La'aretz, they're up to Pinchas. Next week, in Chutz La'aretz, the regularly scheduled reading is Matot Maseh, and we have conveniently split Matot and Maseh. This week reading Matot, next week reading Maseh. When the rest of the world reads Matot and Maseh, so the following week we will all be back together for the Book of Devarim with the Parsha of Devarim with Shabbat Chazon, the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av. Let's say Tehillim Kuf Lamed, and then we'll get down to business. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai, Adonai Shimava Koli, Tihiena Aznecha Kashuvot Lakol Tachanunai, Imavonot Tishmoria Adonai Mia Amod, Ki Imecha Hasalicha Lama'an Tivare, Kiviti Adonai Kivata Nafshi Velidvaro Hochalti, Nafshi Ladonai, Mishomerim Laboker, Shomerim Laboker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'Harbeimo Fidut V'Hu Yifde Et Yisrael Mikol Avonotav Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael Hanetunim Batzara Uvashivya HaOmedim Ebein Bayam Uvein Bayabasha HaMakom Yirachem Aleihem V'Yotzieim Mitzara Lirvacha U'Meafela La'ora U'Mishibud L'Geula Hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv vinomar amen. Okay, let's start with the opening music. Before we do that, let me just remind you that I am in the free form of Torah Tidbits Audio. I am no longer bound by the long time practice of recording exactly 23 minutes and then a second half of exactly 23 minutes. You cannot believe the painstaking detail and time that it took me to whittle down to exactly those times, only to find out that that hasn't been necessary for quite some time now, and all I have to do is submit a single file of Torah Tidbits Audio, and it could be 5 minutes, it could be 3 hours, or anything in between. More realistically, I'm shooting for a minimum of 3/4 of an hour, 45 minutes or thereabouts, to a little over an hour. And that's the way it will continue to be until further notice. The opening music was an a cappella song, a track from an album by Beat Achon. Imeshkachech Yerushalayim is probably the main theme song of the 3 weeks period of mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, because it expresses that if I forget Jerusalem, let my tongue cleave to my palate, and may my right hand wither. The biggest fear of destruction and exile was that the Jewish people would forget Zion, would forget Israel, would forget Jerusalem. And I'll tell you something that just hit me now. And maybe I should not jump to it so quickly. I should let it percolate for a while. But it's a very, very new thought. Im eshkachech Yerushalayim, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, can be, I don't know if interpreted is the right word, but can be expressed as I have done in many, many broadcasts and in many issues of the print Torah Tidbits, although not specifically attaching it to this verse and this song. But when the Jewish people go into exile, the expression that follows Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim is Eich Nashir Et Shir Hashem Al Admat Nechar. How can we sing the song of God on strange lands? And that's pretty much what has happened throughout the many, many, many centuries of exile. Jews have maybe wept at the beginning, but when it came generation after generation of established and growing communities all over the world in Galut, it got to a point where, in essence, people forgot Jerusalem. Oh, they didn't really forget Jerusalem. They know that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, and Israel is the country of the Jewish people, the state of the Jewish people. But forgetting Jerusalem means that you carry on life day by day as if Jerusalem doesn't exist. In other words, establishing a thriving and vital Jewish community with all of the amenities that a Jewish community needs and wants, and being entrenched in such a comfortable situation is, in essence, forgetting Jerusalem. Because a Jew should not say, this is wonderful here. We have everything we need. You don't have everything we need. We don't have Jerusalem. And even when you live in Jerusalem, you don't yet have Jerusalem, but that's another story. Anyway, I didn't want to start that way, but it's a thought that intruded itself upon me. So I'll put it in the way that I was going to. The three-week period from Shivat Arba Tammuz till Tisha B'Av, the intensified portion of that three-week period known as the 9 days from Rosh Chodesh Av through the 9th and halfway through the 10th, the week in which Tisha B'Av falls, Erev Tisha B'Av, Tisha B'Av, these are the days that our sages set aside for mourning the destruction. Let me point out that it's not just these days. There are aspects of mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash throughout the year. They show up in the famous example of breaking a glass at a wedding. They show up in many homes where the custom is followed to leave a square of the wall adjacent to the door, unplastered and unpainted, Zecher Lechurban. Many, many things throughout the year when we're either done to remember the Beit HaMikdash or to remember the Beit HaMikdash being destroyed. So it's not just a three-week period, but that's our focus now. That this three-week period very much has as its theme song, Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim Tishkach Yimini, if I forget the... If I forget Jerusalem, may my right arm wither, which I should have said first before. And Im lo alet Yerushalayim al rosh simchati, tidbak lishoni, may my tongue cleave to my palate if I do not place Jerusalem above my greatest simcha. Now, again, going back to that thought that popped in, here's the next part of it. We associate that with the breaking of the glass at a wedding, saying, here I am celebrating a wedding, my child's wedding, my relative's wedding, my close friend's wedding. And because I don't want to place that personal simcha above Jerusalem, I will break the glass as a sign of destruction to remember Yerushalayim. Im lo a'aleh, if I have not raised Jerusalem above my greatest simcha. Apply that not just to a wedding. Apply that to sitting in your air-conditioned living room on a lounge chair with a remote control to your entertainment system at home and really, really enjoying your evening, you still have the pasuk, Im lo a'ale et Yerushalayim al rosh simchati. Now, you know that this way of my talking always accompanies a pitch for Aliyah. I am more and more convinced that this Israel is the place that God meant all Jews to be. We messed things up and created a situation of destruction and galut, exile, and we have it within our power and ability to repair the sins of our ancestors so that it will be a natural follow-through, the coming of Mashiach, the building of the Beit HaMikdash, and the completion of the ingathering of the exiles. Let me carry the thought of the mourning of the Beit HaMikdash in a different direction for a moment. And this is something I did write about and I spoke about at the center, the Israel Center, the OU Israel Center. And that's the following. There is an aspect to mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and I'll tell you a different way, not one that I already put it in this year, but a new way that you can see this. Coming up to Rosh Chodesh, we bench Rosh Chodesh this Shabbat, Rosh Chodesh Av, it will be Menachem Av, will be the following Friday. That means not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow. And that brings in the period known as the 9 days, the minhag, the custom during the 9 days, except for Shabbat, is not to eat meat or drink wine. Meat and wine are part of a classic definition of joy. Ein simcha ele bebosar v'yayin. Can't really have a good time without meat and wine. I know this doesn't necessarily apply to a vegetarian, but we could discuss that a different time. In addition to basar v'yayin, meat and wine, being a definition of joy, they are also associated with the day-to-day functioning of the Holy Temple, the Beit HaMikdash. The meat, representing the meat of korbanot, of sacrifices, and the wine of libation, both of which are associated with the Mizbeach, the altar. And without the Beit HaMikdash, we don't have the meat of the Korbanot. We don't have the wine of Nesach, of libation. And therefore, it behooves us not to drink wine and eat meat during the period of intense mourning for the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, with the exception of Shabbat. But now let's take that further. What about after Tisha B'Av? Well, the custom is that the 9-day restrictions continue till midday of the 10th day of Av for various reasons. This year, when we'll be fasting on Sunday, because Shabbat is really the 9th of Av, but you can't fast on Shabbat except for Yom Kippur, and therefore the fast got pushed to Sunday, the 10th of Av, and that means with the conclusion of the 10th of Av, conclusion of the fast this year of Tisha B'Av, the restrictions are pretty much lifted. Let's say a person says or feels that destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is something that is so devastating to the Jewish life that I don't feel right about eating meat or drinking wine right after Tisha B'Av. So I extend a personal custom and prohibition until the Shabbat following Tisha B'Av, known as the Shabbat of Comfort, Shabbat Nachamu. Okay, acceptable. Let's say I decide to make a pledge that I will not eat meat or drink wine all year round. That is not acceptable either. And a person would be told, if he consulted a rabbinic authority, that he should ignore that pledge that he made, and he doesn't even need the process of Hatarat Nedarim, which we will talk about in a little while when we take a look at Parshat Matot. Why should we say to this person, you made a pledge, a commitment, not to eat meat or drink wine throughout the year, or let's say every Shabbat or every Tuesday, whatever. And what we are in essence saying is that that's not constructive. Not only is it not constructive, it's counterproductive. Counterproductive means that you are carrying the mourning for the Beit HaMikdash beyond what our sages have set down with their guidelines. And what's wrong with that if you feel emotionally involved more so? What's wrong with it is it negates the concept that the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, albeit that it's been close to 2,000 years, is temporary. There is a plan of building the third Beit HaMikdash. Exactly how that will be accomplished is not the issue. Exactly when is also not the issue, although I'll make it part of the issue in a moment. But we must believe with a complete heart that there will be a third Beit HaMikdash, there will be an end to the exile, there will be an end to the shabby, for lack of a different word, treatment of the Jewish people throughout the world, attitude towards Israel, that there will be a change for the better in all of the above during the Messianic era. A person who abstains from meat and wine and anything else because there is no Beit HaMikdash needs to stick to the constructive suggestions and guidelines of our sages. And when you overdo it, you are not being strict. You are getting into the territory where it can be construed as a rejection of the fact that this is temporary. We would definitely mourn differently if we didn't believe on a personal basis in life after death, in Tchiyat HaMetim, the revival of the dead, because then a loss would be so devastating, gone, person's gone, out of my life and out of any existence, how can you be consoled for something like that? On the other hand, if you believe with a complete heart that there is such a thing as Olam Haba, Tchiyat HaMetim, Olam HaEmet, etc., then your loss can be mourned properly and constructively, following, as I said, the guidelines of our sages. Same thing on a national level. You say, 3 weeks? Why just 3 weeks? Why not from one Tisha B'Av to the next, year-round mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash? No, year-round mourning would indicate, whether it's true or not in an individual instance, is not the point, but it will indicate a lack of belief that something better is coming. Before we move on from the topic of the 3 weeks to Parshat Matot, and I hope we will get back to it in an interesting tie-in, I want to play a track from one of the Maccabees album, the a cappella group from Yeshiva University. The album is called Out of the Box, and the track is called Habet. There is a prayer that is said after the Amidah of Shacharit and Mincha called Tachanun. Tachanun is a series of supplications apparently deemed necessary or appropriate, better word, on plainer days that are not quite sad, but days that don't have a happy feel to them. I don't know if I want to get too much into that. Take my word for it, it's a prayer. On Mondays and Thursdays at Shacharit, it is an expanded version of Tachanun. And one passage says the following. Look down from heaven, we say to God, and see how we have become an object of scorn and derision among the nations. This was true a long time ago. It is true to a certain extent to this very day. You hear anti-Jewish rhetoric and sentiment, and we witness actions. We have, in certain segments of the world's population, always been an object of scorn and derision. Excuse me. We are regarded as sheep led to the slaughter, to be killed, destroyed, beaten, and humiliated. But look how we end that prayer. Yet despite all this, we have not forgotten your name. Please do not forget us. This fits whenever we say Tachanun. It fits on a day as part of the 3 week mourning period for the Beit HaMikdash, because these two go hand in hand. Habet by the Maccabees.
Shabbat.
Parshat Matot is that of Nidarim, vows. It includes vows and oaths and promises and pledges, which all have slightly different meanings. But the basic idea is if a person commits himself to do something that he is not obligated to do, or forbids himself from doing something that he is not forbidden to do by Jewish law. That's basically what we're talking about in the context of a neder. The written word in the Torah, which I read at the beginning of the show, says, ish, if a person. Here, specifically a man, because there's a section about women as well. If a person makes a vow to God or swears to forbid something to himself, to his soul, lo yachel divaro, he may not profane his word, kechol hayotze mipiv yaaseh, according to whatever comes from his mouth shall he do. That is not the sum total of what the Torah has to say about neder, but it says it all, but not quite. Following this piece, we have two Torah examples of where a vow is not as binding as would seem to be from the first verse that I just read. In other words, it's the except. If a woman makes a vow that affects her husband, the husband has the authority on the day that he hears about the vow to announce that he is nullifying it. and the vow is no longer binding on his wife. So to a father of a girl between the age of 12 and 12 and a half, 12 is the age of bat mitzvah, a girl has a status for that half year called na'ara, where the father has the authority on the day that he hears of her pledge to nullify it. That is called hafarat nidarim, not to be confused with hatarat nidarim, which we'll talk about later, soon. So far what we have is the written Torah in Parshat Matot, saying if a person makes any kind of promise or pledge, he cannot profane his word, and he has to do whatever he said he was going to do. Then we have the specific exceptions of certain kinds of vows of a wife, of a daughter who is a na'ara, that can be nullified. And that's it for what the Torah says in the written word. So if you stop it at that, and you ask the question, I promised I would do such and such, I find it very difficult to do now, can I get out of it? The answer was no. The Torah says, Kechol hayotzei mipiv ya'aseh. Lo yachel devaro, you can't profane your name. Whatever you say, you have to do. However, our Torah is only partly in writing. There is an oral Torah, the oral law, as presented to us in the Talmud, but it is essentially oral. The oral law says, and this is not created by human beings, this is part of God's law, that when a neder, a pledge, a promise, a vow, an oath, is said with the mouth different from the way it is felt in the heart, that is a kind of vow that is subject to being nullified. So, let's take an example. A person gets on the scale, is not happy with his weight, and blames it on Ben and Jerry's various flavors of ice cream to which he is addicted. Chunky Monkey and Stubble Fudge this and Cookies and Cream and all of that stuff. And he promises that he's not going to touch Ben and Jerry's again or for a year. Now, he started exercising and watching his diet and has lost an impressive amount of weight and would like to occasionally indulge his love of Ben and Jerry's ice cream. It seems that he's not allowed because he promised not to eat Ben and Jerry's anymore. And the Torah says he cannot profane his word, and whatever he says, he has to keep. But he's troubled by that. And there is a system known as Hatarat Nedarim, where he appears before a rabbi who is an expert on the laws of vows, or before a panel of three adult Jewish males who form a Beit Din. And essentially he explains to them what he promised and says that had I realized when I promised it that it would be something I had to keep forever, even if my weight would go back to where I wanted to be, and that had I realized this at the time, I would have specified something like, I'm not going to eat Ben and Jerry's until my weight is down. Or I would have said, I'm not going to eat Ben and Jerry's anymore, Berlin Edder, without a commitment. Then, in essence, the rabbi or the Beit Din accepts the notion that what he said was not exactly the same as what he meant. And on that basis, they could be Matir Neder. They can unbind him from his vow. Now I ask you a question. Take a system of law that follows the written word of the Torah and does not accept the oral law. And take a system which has the written word joined by the oral law. And the result would be, here is a guy that could never eat Ben and Jerry's ice cream the rest of his life because he made that promise and he has to keep it. And here is a guy who, for whom it was determined that his mouth and his heart were not properly synchronized on that pledge, and they released him from the vow. Who is strict and who is lenient? That's the question for you. And I want to try to build a case that the written word follower, let's call him a Karaite or a Tzedoki, is stricter but less strict on the real meaning of a vow. Because just because you say something, if you don't mean it in your heart, if you're coerced into saying it, if you're angry and you say it that way, if you exaggerate something, and a whole variety of other things, just because you said something, what kind of idea is it that, however ridiculous the situation might be, you have to keep what you said? Imagine a mother saying to a kid, if you don't eat every single pea on that plate, you will not step foot out of this house for the next month. In a system that takes literally Lo yachel dvaro kichol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh, would have to say that since the kid did not eat every pea on his house, he cannot leave that house for a month. The traditional Jewish halacha, Torah, says mothers say those kind of things to encourage their children to eat the peas on their plate. They do not mean in their heart that this kid should not leave the house for a month. And therefore, they, our sages, in the oral law, have canceled such a vow without even needing an act of nullification. So, in essence, what sounds like a leniency is really a strict attitude towards a real vow. You make a real vow, a real pledge, you are bound to keep it. It's only when it's not real because you didn't really, really think it out or feel it in your heart, then it's not even a pledge. And whether you need Hatart Nedarim or not is a halachic question. But that's not the kind of pledge that the Torah means when it says, Lo yachel dvaro en kechol hayotzei mipiv ya'aseh. Now I must add that because the concept of Hatarat Nedarim, nullifying of vows, is essentially from the oral law. This particular topic in Jewish law becomes the epitome of the belief in the written and the oral law, or the lack of that belief. In other words, it separates, as they used to say, the men from the boys. Because to say, oh, this says it in writing, and therefore I will abide by it, but you're telling me that there's an oral tradition passed down from Sinai? I don't accept that. No. It is a very fundamental element in our belief system that there is an oral law which explains the written word and is not inseparable. It is inseparable from it. It cannot be cut off, because that tends to lead to gross distortion and misunderstandings of the written word, which I've spoken about many times. Following this topic of Nedarim, Moshe Rabbeinu is told to go to war with the people of Israel against Midian to avenge the honor of God and the honor of the people of Israel for what Midian had attempted to do, and unfortunately what they also succeeded at doing, of attracting many of the men of Israel to the immorality and idolatry of Midian. And the Torah describes the battle and the aftermath and the booty and the division of the booty between the people and the soldiers and various other issues, which I won't get into now. Then the Torah tells us that the tribes of Reuven and Gad had a noticeable abundance of livestock, and they were quite attracted to the territory that they were in, the area on the east bank of the Jordan, and basically came to Moshe Rabbeinu and the leaders of the tribes to request that they be given permission to settle there. Moshe's reaction was very much anger at the thought that here we go again about the sin of the spies. And here's your tie-in. Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies, is associated with Tisha B'Av. And this reading, Matot, is always during the three-week period leading up to Tisha B'Av. And here we go again. So Moshe got angry and said, you are discouraging the rest of the people from going into the promised land where they're supposed to be going. And I'll tell you something, no matter how it comes out, that Moshe administers an oath to the people of Gad and Reuven and then half of Shevet Menashe, that they have to leave their families and livestock in temporary dwellings and go across the Jordan with their brothers, and only after conquest and settlement of the main body of Israel can they return to this area. And that's what happened. Still, there is that element of we can live a full life here any place else. That's Chet HaMeraglim. That's the difficulty in what Reuven and Gad asked for. That's the difficulty in many diaspora Jews today, when they choose to go across the Jordan, so to speak, and fight together with their brethren. They come and they volunteer in times of war. They give money and nice contributions for the war effort and the defense effort, but they remain where they are. Be it Borough Park or Muncie or Teaneck or the Five Towns or Golders Green or fill in any community that you want. That's not what God had in mind for the Jewish people, even when he lets them. Keep that in mind. To me, that's a powerful lesson of Matot. And that's basically the Sedra, and it's basically it for this week's edition of Torah Tidbits Audio. So just as a reminder, this Shabbat, Parshat Matot here in Israel, Parshat Pinchas in Chutz La'aretz, in either case, we bench Rosh Chodesh Menachem Av, and we announce this Shabbat, Rosh Chodesh Menachem Av, Yehiyeh B'Yom HaShishi Haba Aleinu L'Tova, on the following Friday. That would correspond to August 5th, and that will begin the period of the 9 days. So until next show, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, L'Hishtameah.